You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.
Hi, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Today, my guest is Chuck Collins. He is the author of several works of nonfiction, including most recently, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions, and his debut novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun, a near future story of one community facing climate disruption, came out this May. Chuck Collins became famous and perhaps notorious in the 1980s. He is the great-grandson of Oscar F. Meyer, the founder of the Oscar Meyer Meat Company. My baloney has a first name. It's O-S-C-A-R. My baloney has a second name. It's M-A-Y-E-R. You know the song. When he was 26, he received an inheritance of $500,000, what would be around $1.4 million today. Instead of either spending or investing the money or some combination thereof, he decided to give it all away by donating all of it to various foundations. Today, Chuck is the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits the website inequality.org. He is an expert on U.S. inequality and the racial wealth divide and author of over 10 books and dozens of reports about inequality, climate disruption, philanthropy, the racial wealth divide, affordable housing, and billionaire wealth dynasties. Praise for Chuck's work is voluminous. Truly a who's who in politics, academia, and policy circles share their admiration for his book, The Wealth Hoarders. Senator Bernie Sanders is one of them, Brooke Harrington, professor of sociology at Dartmouth College, another, and David K. Johnson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, Perfectly Legal, yet another. I'll just share a taste for their praise. David K. said, while government takes out taxes before we get paid, the wealthiest avoid taxes with trusts, evade taxes with help from tax haven governments, and escape the IRS because Congress hobbles tax law enforcement. Collins, who rejected the privilege of his birth, explains in plain English how wealth hoarding works and shows how we can stop this costly corruption. Okay, let's dive in. Hey, how are you?
Good. Good to be with you.
I can't tell by the wallpaper, but am I guessing correctly that you're in Vermont?
Yeah, I'm in an old 1804 farmhouse that has, I don't know, the wallpaper's probably 100 years old.
I bet if you peeled it off, the whole wall would come with it.
Yeah, it's probably like horsehair plaster, you know, or something like
that. Yes, because we have a house that's not quite as old, and the wallpaper was already peeling, and it was like horsehair plaster, like over the lath. It's kind of cool when you look at the anatomy of an old house. Where are you in Vermont? If you don't want to say.
No, you know, if I'm right in across the Massachusetts line in Guilford, Vermont, near Brattleboro. So.
Oh, that okay.
So you could ride your bike up here, Jen. You know, on a good Saturday.
I mean, I don't know if the bike paths go all the way up, though, do they?
No, but there's some bike path-like back roads.
You know, every time I was just up in Brattleboro a few weeks ago, and it's such a cool community. It like makes me want to be a better person. And it's getting more developed than where I live in Northampton now. There are plenty of coffee shops and like used clothes shops, and people are just hanging around. You know, and that sort of, you could walk in there and like, it could be 1970 or it could be today. They all, right? It's like same kind of groovy vibe. Is that, what's going on there? Is it changing in terms of being more sustainable? What's your sense of it?
It's a great place to live. It has a lot of the challenges of being sort of the main town in a rural county, you know, there's a lot of the back to the land influence here still. Uh-huh. Like all these people moved back to the land in the 60s and 70s and they sort of stayed in place and they brought their sensibilities here.
But I see young people, people like in their 30s now.
There's a very vibrant music scene and a lot of young people getting into farming and food-related businesses.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of, I think of Windham County, Brattleboro area as kind of the Silicon Valley of resilient living. You know, we're kind of piloting and testing out a lot of things that might be useful in the coming decades.
And have you been there for decades? Speaking of decades, did you live somewhere else before this?
Yeah, I mean, I lived 30 years in Jamaica Plain in Boston.
Okay.
Raised kids there. We had a cabin here in this town of Guilford, Vermont, a little off the grid cabin, and we would come up here, you know, as kind of visitors.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we connected to this town. And for many years, I lived in Greenfield. So I literally did ride my bike up the Green River.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you would, but you always had the cabin. And then did you build onto the cabin? Or is this the cabin that you're talking about?
No, we bought a farm a mile down the road from the cabin that has luxuries like electricity and running water. And my cousin and their partner farm this land. So we actually have a market garden.
Oh.
And a berry patch and
really
tap a lot of trees for maple syrup and all that. So
and there's a place to boil it down. Do you sell the syrup or is that just for your own use?
We kind of just use it and barter it and gift it.
Oh my goodness. And wow. And so you say electricity. Is it the old knob and tube wiring or did you replace it?
Well, this house is, we've upgraded it.
Yeah. We had to get insurance.
Wood stove. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
And are you out there gardening or farming yourself? Or?
You know, my goal is to spend 2 hours a day outside. So, mm-hmm. I just came in from stacking firewood, which is a very common thing to do in October and November in Vermont. So,
right. You know, that's actually an interesting goal. I like that so much more than when people say, I want to exercise, I want to walk, or the idea of spending 2 hours outside. I started spending more time outside during COVID. It was a necessity. And for a while, I was still doing that, and I'm a little bit more indoor bound, and I think that's not—it's not great. I think that's a good goal, especially this time of year when we get so closed up in the stale air and not around people or nature. So that's—I like your goal. So I think it's so great that I finally met you in real life. I knew your work. Your work, both your written work as well as the work you do in various communities. And then it was just so crazy to run into you at the airport. And I think it was either February or March of 2022, and we were both flying back from DC. I think we were at the conference the Patriotic Millionaires put on. And I didn't realize until I was researching to speak with you today that you were one of the co-founders. So can you was that with Erica Payne and Morris Pearl and those folks? Can you talk a little bit about how you came to be part of that, you know, be a founding member and what they do? Because I think not a lot of people know their important work.
Yeah. I guess it was 1997, I helped co-found a group called Responsible Wealth, which was, you know, trying to organize high net worth people to speak out for tax fairness. And we had one big kind of event, which was Bill Gates Sr., the father, the founder of Microsoft, joined our campaign to defend the estate tax. And it got a lot of news, and it actually, I think, had a huge impact because it got the news media interested in who pays the estate tax and why are people trying to get rid of it and who really, you know, benefits from the repeal of the estate tax. And so in that sense, we stopped the repeal of the estate tax. And that became a playbook, which was how do you engage wealthy people in defending progressive tax policy? And so then we had a network called Wealth for the Common Good. Then and Erica and Morris and folks were involved in starting. It was kind of a media stunt initially, the Patriotic Millionaires.
That's what I think. But when I spoke with Erica, she said, yeah. Right.
But then when we decided to, you know, make it a formalized organization, I was like, well, I'll fold this project into the people we've recruited, and I went on the board and have stayed on the board. So it's a, now it's a real organization with major program and staff and, you know, working to press for fair tax policy.
When you say it was maybe just to get press attention, was it around a particular, was there some legislation happening, do you think, at the time? Or do you know what it might have been? I'm not remembering.
It was the Bush tax cuts were going to expire in 2008 or 2009, and Obama was the president, and he was sort of seriously considering extending the Bush tax cuts, which largely benefited the rich. And so having, you know, 150 high net worth people stand up and do a press conference calling on him not to do that actually, we think, had an impact. So that was really the first sort of public unveiling of the patriotic millionaires for fiscal strength.
Yeah, it's great. And I think one of the research the group does, I'm sure you've seen the book Tax the Rich. And I know maybe some of that was things that they had online, but it's really a helpful, really clear book with diagrams if anyone can understand about some of the basic loopholes and advantages that the 1% have over the rest of the world. So I also found out that you founded in the 90s United for a Fair Economy. I mean, you are you're someone who likes to start things. How did you fund that? And what, at one time, I think you were a leader of that organization. What do they do?
Well, that was an organization co-founded with Felicia Skell, another great Hampshire County, Massachusetts leader. She and I were the founding co-directors. And our mission was really to draw attention to economic inequality, not just look at poverty, but the ways in which the concentration of wealth and power matters and distorts things. And that was in 1995. Mm-hmm. I was co-directed that for more than 10 years. And we did a lot of like popular education and kind of creative ways of communicating the levels of inequality. You know, this was before Thomas Piketty, before Occupy. Mm-hmm. Right. Back, so we were sort of incubating a kind of perspective on the harms caused by extreme inequality.
And may her memory be a blessing. It's very sad. I remember, am I remembering correctly that at one point she had actually opened up like a dog daycare place in Northampton too? Am I remembering this right? Okay, because I think But so I think it's interesting though, out of this place, the Pioneer Valley and, you know, Southern Vermont, there are a lot of people here who are have been at the forefront of dealing with these questions, as you said, before Piketty was doing his research, even with Saez, before it became a central focus. You know, some of this maybe just dates, maybe it's in the water, maybe it dates back to Sojourner Truth, you know, coming through here. I don't know what it is about this place. Do you have any thoughts about that?
No, but I've sort of, I call it the 413 phenomena, the area code, and there's a little bit of an 802 Vermont area code, but there is some innovation here. It's not the like innovation people think of when they think of like Silicon Valley or the 128. It's social change innovation happening here, and maybe the some connection to the five colleges. But I think it's, you know, partly it's smaller face-to-face rural towns that have town meeting and that are attractive to alternative thinking,
So I think it's also funny that both of us ended up here, of all places. It turns out that we found out at the airport that we had something in common, although at a different period of time. We both went to the same high school back in Michigan, and we're both part of this performing dance troupe with this beloved institution at our school, Cranbrook Kingswood. Her name was Jessica Sinclair, and it was such a big deal, I thought, to be a Jesse Sinclair dancer, modern dance troupe. It was the first time I ever went to Europe. Was on a trip with her. It was a transformative. But the other thing I want to that you don't know, that I'm going to spring on you now, is that finally reading your book, The Wealth Hoarders, I found out that Kurt Vonnegut's book, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, made an impression on you. I finally, I don't know if I ever read it, but I finally read it about 5 months ago. And I was blown away about how that book completely holds up. A friend recommended that I read it. And it just, it's at the inner, you know, because I'm interested in the intersection of money and law and power. And that's the book. And I just loved how much of the way you talk about wealth hoarding, how you sort of begin, you know, in a preface talking about that. So can you, you can jump in now. I'll let you talk about your dancing experience or Kurt Vonnegut or both.
Well, being a Jesse Sinclair dancer, as you said, was maybe the peak experience of my life. It's been all downhill since, in terms of, I mean, I still like to dance, but I was a soccer player. I was a soccer goalie, and these women recruited me to say, hey, you know, you should join the dance troupe. When else will you ever be in a performing dance troupe? And I was totally enraptured by that idea. And so so I was, you know, lucky to, just like you, get to be part of a performance group, work with this amazing choreographer who would sit us down at the, as we prepared for the big performances, and would essentially say, you belong to me now. Your time is mine. You will come to, you will give up all your other pursuits. Anyway, so she was great.
She just timeless. And the photo you had of her from the 70s, she looked exactly the same in the 80s. She kind of this kinky, long, she's very petite, maybe 5'1", kind of this kinky brown hair, always had some kind of bandana pulling her hair back, and was always wearing like, you know, a leotard and parachute pants. That was like how she walked around. Was the dance room at the back of the gym kind of near the lake? Is that where you?
Yeah. Yeah. And we would kind of spill out under the grass.
Yes.
Dance around that dancing maiden statue there.
Yes. And did you ever go up the hill to the Carl Millis fountain of the Orpheus fountain and kind of imitate the sculptures?
Right. We would try to mimic, you know, one of them is Beethoven, the rest of Mark.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's, we just got to go to high school in kind of an amazing place.
Everyone should, yeah. You know, it's really, yeah, I went exactly. Back home to see my family this summer. My father's not doing well. And my husband indulged me and let me go park the car at the art museum and just walk around campus. And I don't know. I just don't even know how lucky I was at that time. And now it's it's so inaccessible to ordinary people to begin with, but even now, even more so. But, you know, I have those memories. Okay, Kurt Vonnegut. Oh, wait. But so did you graduate from Cranbrook? Did you?
Yeah.
So I wonder if you had any of the same English teachers or history teachers or anything like that. Who are the ones that you loved?
Well, let's see.
It wasn't co-ed, though, by then. Yeah, was
no,
it?
No, I would. I
some
started,
classes were, right?
After ninth grade, classes were co-ed.
Yes, us too.
Yeah. So, you know, I did have great, Mr. Shaw, Charlie Shaw.
Shaw was there?
He was just arrived.
You know, he's my friend on Facebook now. I love him. Yeah. I still remember, I took his English class and he taught Gatsby, right? Did you take that? So I remember we were talking about something and I said, and it doesn't even matter. But like, I remember he taught Gatsby and one thing he did is he read us F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda's like what their debts were or something like that. You know, he just brought all that to life. He was amazing.
Yeah. There were some great teachers. I had great science teachers and
Wait, so then where did you go from there though after that?
You know, I was the only person not to go to college immediately after.
Good for you.
I wanted to do something else. I wanted a little more life experience. I actually came to Worcester, Massachusetts.
From Michigan.
And did a one-year internship apprenticeship program there where I got involved with the Clamshell Alliance trying to keep the Seabrook Power Plant from being built. So I had like a little, you know, I spent a couple of years living in Worcester and eventually ended up in the Valley at Hampshire College.
That was the other, now it all makes sense because that's the other connection because my husband Michael went to Hampshire. Hampshire's the most amazing place. Were you there when, what's his name, the filmmaker was here?
Ken Burns?
Yeah.
Yeah. I overlapped with him a little bit and actually kind of looked like him. We had the same sort of...
I could see that from that.
Little bit scraggly beard. And so people would think I was Ken Burns for just a millisecond. So I traded on that momentary fame.
So I know that at Hampshire, they don't have majors. They have like this thing called Div 3. Did they have that then?
Yeah,
Division 3?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what was your like project at college on?
My senior thesis, my Div 3, was on anti-communism and American culture. Sort of trying to understand the two Red Scares, the one after World, you know, the sort of Palmer Raids after World War One, and then the, obviously McCarthyism, mm-hmm. and sort of how that shaped American politics. So, you know, it's more historical.
So cool.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.
Okay, so now we're about to get to the part like what most of the world knows you for. So if you took a little time off, how old were you when you graduated from Hampshire then?
Maybe 23. Right?
Okay. Yeah. So you did something for a little while, and then all of a sudden you came into an inheritance, right? So that's the part. I mean, you probably are sick of talking about this, but like if I have that jingle in my head from Oscar Mayer Bologna, you're going to have to talk about your heritage. There's just no.
Fair,
want me to sing
fair.
It to you or no?
Fair enough. You can. I would.
Can you? Do you know it?
I wish I was an Oscar Mayer Wiener.
No. My baloney has a first name. That one. You know it?
It's Mayer. My baloney has a last name. It's Oscar.
Oh, you did it backwards. The first name is Oscar.
Oh. That's right. That's right.
I love it.
Yeah,
I love
you know,
it.
I'm more. I once was speaking at a conference though of all these international nuns, and you know, one of them was trying to explain. They were introducing me and trying to explain. You know, Oscar Mayer is a very well-known brand in the United States, and all these French nuns are sitting there like, "What?" And then all the American nuns break into singing, "I wish I was an Oscar Mayer Wiener."
Oh, because that is so funny.
The jingle was kind of embedded in them, so. So yeah, that's my my great-grandfather was Oscar Mayer.
So just hold on. Like the idea that you were at a conference and a bunch of American nuns broke out in song and sang, "I wish I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener," is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life on so many levels. I just can't even. Okay, but that was your...
It should have been an outtake of Sound of Music or something.
Exactly. Anyhow, you're... Great-grandfather was Oscar Mayer, right?
Yeah.
But that means there are a lot of cousins. Did they all inherit at the same time? Like, what went down there with that?
It was different in every family. I mean, I am literally the fourth generation. My father was third generation. We still all get together every couple of years at our family reunion, me and 300 of my closest relatives. And you have a little button that says Gen 3, Gen 4. So now there's Gen 6, these little kids walking around. Some of them are actually named Oscar Mayer.
Are you kidding?
Oscar Mayer the 6th, poor kid. Jesus. Anyway.
That's a choice.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're a nice kid if you're listening. That's not the issue, really. Okay, so you have these sort of, and is it nice, though? Is it nice to see all these cousins? I mean, is it?
They are, I'm very close to some of my cousins. One of them lives with me and grows vegetables.
We all
dress up and put our lederhosen and we have German
really?
Night yeah with the
that sounds fun
the dirndls and the lederhosen and the all the
like
sausage
hot pretzels could, and beer and stuff
hot pretzel necklaces. Yeah,
I wish I had a family that had like hot pretzel necklaces. Okay, yeah. But let's go back. So like here's the thing is you talk about this in your book and obviously earlier work, you were told you were going to come into some money and you thought a lot about giving it away. And there are a lot of people who tried to dissuade you from that, said, just don't touch the principal. Like you can, you know, invest it in something, whatever, but you can live off the interest, but just don't touch the principal. And you thought it through and said, nah, I'm going to give it away. Did you give it all away or just most of it? Or
Well, I don't know if you have any 25-year-olds in your life, but
I have a 23-year-old, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
you can't tell them what to do.
It's pretty all or nothing, if you know what I mean.
Yes, so, I do know. Yeah, I do.
So, yeah, my 25-year-old self, bless me as a young person, felt that the right thing to do was to give all the money away that I had inherited and make my own way. That's what I thought, you know. And I now look back and realize there's 101 other inherited advantages that kind of flowed my way that have buoyed me along.
Well, just the school we talked about, right? I mean, that alone, just the confidence that you get when people tell you you belong. That's it, right?
Yeah. There's a sociology book called Prepped for Power about what does it mean to go to a school like Cranbrook where the assumption is you are being trained to take your place at the head of the boardroom table or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, disinherited in that sense and have not had inherited wealth. And so it's kind of a little bit of an experiment. What happens when you have somebody with all this generational wealth and advantage and access and you take away their cash? What mm-hmm. happens? Here I am. So I'm the good news is I'm fine, you know.
And your kids probably are fine, yeah.
They are fine, and that's actually.
Are they mad at you?
No, they're not. They're not. And one of them is really eloquent about that why it was a good thing that you know, the fact that she went to the Boston Public Schools, she learned fluent Spanish. You know, they're much better equipped to live in a more equitable society than I will ever be.
You gave them a gift that you couldn't give them if they had the money. I mean, I think I kind of went through a similar thing when I left the corporate law world where, I mean, there are a number of things or inside counsel, the world of finance when I left that. And because it was all fascinating, I really enjoyed it, but I wanted to do something different with my life. Because like you said, you know, my training, it wasn't like, everything was handed to me. I worked really hard in school and I got into, you know, an Ivy League college, blah, blah, blah. That's not the point. But the point is that was the track, right? Like I was following like the track. And I said, you know, wait, I just want to write books and sit around and read books all day. And I'm not going to be able to do that as a lawyer. But I understood that if I gave up, I knew what job I was taking, teaching at UMass at that time. And I knew what that meant in terms of giving up money and not being able to like provide a private school for my kid at that time or do what, you know, all that stuff that I'd been given that I thought a person needed. And I just said, you know, I'll have more time with my kid and I just have to make an experiment here, you know, and she's doing great. Like she went to public high school and then I was able to kind of get some financial aid for college so she could go to different, you know, like it's, you figure out how to be a real person in the world. You know, if you make those choices. So I don't know. I mean, of course we come with all this other, you know, sort of generations of stories and, you know, feeling entitled and all that stuff too. But still, it feels good not to feel imprisoned because what I would have been doing is giving up my dreams so that my kid could then follow the track they're supposed to so they could give up their dreams. You know what I mean? And on and on and on. I don't think that makes sense. So I did the math. I mean, I know it's all or nothing, but I was like, well, what if he kept half of it? And if you kept half of it and put it in S&P 500, I did the math and that would have been like $16 million. But you know what? So what? You'd be wanting to give that away now anyway, right? I mean, it's like, I think you did better by example and you were doing what you did before people like Bill Gates and others and Warren Buffett made those oaths and whatever. And, you know, I don't know. I think it was probably scary to do and I'm glad that you did. I want to ask you, I've read two of your books for today, both The Wealth Hoarders and Altar to an Erupting Sun. And I normally talk to nonfiction writers, but I always make an exception for novelists if they've written nonfiction before. So I think what I want to do, I mean, I think that we talked a little bit about inequality here. Let's just jump to the novel first because it's the latest. Then we can go back and talk about, I think, the other book, The Wealth Hoarders. So I don't want to, you know, whenever I'm talking to someone about a novel, I'm really cautious about giving away too much of the story. But I think I think it's okay to talk about the beginning because the sort of biggest dramatic event happens at the beginning. So can you talk a little bit about the setup of this so I don't have to, you know, give away the opening scenes? So you can do that.
Yeah. And there's no spoiler alert here because it's kind of part of the promotion and the story in it. And there's a provocative event that happens in the first four pages. Basically, it is a story. It's actually set in the area that you and I have been talking about, sort of Franklin County, Western Massachusetts, Southern Vermont. My main character is a woman named Ray Kelleher, who grew up in the Midwest, working class, went to Amherst College and dropped out in 1973. But she was part of and formed by a bunch of social movements, the movement against nuclear power and against U.S. intervention in Central America. And she really is exposed to sort of nonviolent, creative social change, direct action. And she's a leader in that space. And so the book actually begins, though, now. It actually starts literally April 2023. This fictional Ray Kelleher is now almost 70. She's facing down a terminal illness. She doesn't have long to live. And she decides to go out in kind of a shocking act. She takes her own life and the life of a CEO of a fossil fuel company who she holds responsible for delaying society's response to climate change. And so, boom, that's kind of the provocative beginning. Then the book jumps forward 7 years, you know, 2030, to look at the impact of her action on her community, on her husband, on her sort of adopted daughter, and on society as a whole. And so there's a little future fiction, speculative mm-hmm. fiction element here, suggesting that humanity is starting to sort of turn the corner a little bit. And there's a lot of experimentation and a lot of innovation happening in terms of resilient living and you know, people living together in harmony with the earth and each other.
Especially, I thought I noticed that, like, you know, with climate change, people having to move and relocate north and what that does, I thought that was really interesting.
The region is experiencing more climate refugees and people fleeing from cities that are becoming less livable. Mm-hmm. And yeah, at that 7 years in the future point, her husband Reggie and others have gathered, and he says, "Well, I've had a little bit of time to think about this, and I've been reading Ray's journals, and I've looked at all these books and the passages she's underlined over the years, and let me tell you why I think she did what she did." And that's the historical part of the story, which goes back to the early 70s and sort of follows Ray's life and follows the social movements and people she meets along the way. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's a story about formation. How do people become who they are? Not just the influence of other people, but the influence of the sort of social movements around her.
That was, you know, I thought you really got into the mind quite well of, you know, what it would feel like to be an early 20-year-old, you know, full scholarship to Amherst College and, you know, feeling, you know, alienated in a classroom where, although I love George Eliot, you know, talking about some abstract theory around Middlemarch. And then, you know, meanwhile, these people on a farm nearby, you know, feet in the earth, you know, feeling closer to them. And you sort of understand why, given her own childhood in Ohio, but like just, and you know, and also of the era, right, in the early 70s. It's really, I think you capture that well. And I wonder, and you also have her working in a pickle factory. And I just, and then you had a lawyer named Tom Lesser, which actually happens to be a lawyer nearby here. And so I was like, okay, I wonder if that's a little wink to some people nearby that you'll mention a name or two. But some of these things seem familiar. And I'm wondering how much of, obviously, the character, this didn't happen and the characters are original, but it feels like you drew a lot from your own community or stories you had been told. Am I getting that right?
I would say stories that I learned. Okay. I was kind of like 10 years younger than some of the main characters and things that were happening, but they were kind of like my inspiration and elders. And the book is called Altar to an Erupting Sun, and you think of like a Day of the Dead altar or an altar where you have photos of family members. That's in a sense, this book is in part a altar to this region and to certain real people. And one of them is Sam Lovejoy, who was an attorney who toppled a tower. He did sort of an act of, I guess at the time people thought of it as property destruction. He clipped the cables on a tower that was taking readings for a future nuclear power plant. And his friend, attorney Tom Lesser, in real life, did help defend him against charges of felony charges.
So you did a little bit of like a John Dos Passos new historical realism. Wait, what am I? There's a name. I can't remember the name for this where it's fiction, but you bring in real life elements, right?
Real life and real life people.
Yeah.
There's a guy, Brian Wilson, not the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson, but who was a Vietnam vet. Actually, I knew him when he lived in Greenfield. He eventually blockaded a train in Concord, California and lost his legs. That really happened. And actually part of this book is, it's a little bit of a salute or a hats off or a wink to real people. And I think people of a certain generation will see themselves in this story. And for younger readers, it's a window into some of these social movements. And my daughter was one of my helpful readers, and a lot of younger people have read it and said, wow, I really wanted to learn more about the history of these real social movements. And I don't know about you, but sometimes fiction is a gateway to history.
I think that I always felt either biography or historical fiction. I think that's the word I'm looking for. I found historical fiction to give me that access because when they taught history in high school, that was one thing I think they did a terrible job of. It was always like, learn these battles and these dates, and it's like that. And I thought, well, history is boring. And then history is like my favorite thing now. But when you look at it through the lens of social movements or social history or even micro history or like financial history or economic history, these ways of thinking about how people cope with different forces in their life or traditions or whatever. So what there's a lot of wisdom that's shared and a lot of among the people that Ray and Alex and the others are around on this farm type commune place. And here's one thing that I just loved. It's early in the book. It's on page 9. And I guess it's an omniscient narrator or someone's telling this to one of the characters. And here's what you wrote. The hot anger types would flame out impulsively, turn off allies. The cold anger types could strategize, build alliances, think long term, and persist. So I'm thinking you must be a cold anger type.
I've definitely persisted. Yeah, I think if I was hot anger type, I would have flamed out a while ago. But and actually, that actually comes from a real organizer named Ernesto Cortez. He was one of the great organizers from Texas. And he said, what you want to find in a leader, and this is speaking as a community organizer, is somebody who has cold anger. You want to find, the hot anger types are not going to last, and they're going to piss off everybody, and they're going to turn people away. You want to find that person who was wounded or scarred or insulted at a younger age and is, by some corporation or some situation, and they are going to basically lay in wait and get back, And so it's that cold anger that kind of propels them along for the long haul.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.
A Okay, so there was this other, so I'm going to mirror this with this other passage, because this brings up, like, we could have a whole philosophical discussion, which I'm hoping we can a little bit. But now we're into page 34, and this is from the point of view of a character named Alex, who is the person at the very beginning of the book who drives Ray to the destination where she's going to do this sort of violent end of her life and political statement, blowing up herself and this oil executive. Okay, so here's what Alex thinks. As she has learned, within the political left, there are growing splinters between lifestyle hippies. Actually, this might be from Ray's point of view. I'm sorry, it's Ray. When she was younger. Sorry, it's not Alex. As she has learned, within the political left, there are growing splinters between lifestyle hippies, political organizers, and militant revolutionaries. The farm is not your get-high, drop-out commune, as other back-to-the-land experiments appear to be. Ray finds that the residents are serious-minded and interested in radical change, even revolution, though clearly within a tradition of nonviolence. The armed struggle factions seem to remain in urban areas or have gone underground. That really resonated for me right now with what's going on in the streets in the U.S. and across the globe. Nonviolence is so important to me. It's essential. And I'm seeing, a lot more of the sort of by any means militants on the left, in a sense, digging their own grave, because I think they're going to lose sympathy for their causes. But maybe I'm wrong. I'm just, so I want maybe you to address that, given that the book begins with this sort of violent moment. It almost reminds me of Spike Lee's movie, Do the Right Thing. I don't want to spoil that movie. That struggle between, the sort of like, are you going to be MLK or are you going to be Malcolm X kind of thing? So how do you struggle with this question, without giving away too much of the book, between resistance and sort of nonviolent revolutionary change, and this some people's urge to commit violence?
Well, this is you're really getting to the heart of why I even would write this book, which is I wanted to explore, and fiction was the place to do it. How do we face the impossible news of this future climate disruption, this present and future climate disruption, and how tactically do we respond to it? And what does bold action look like on a warming planet? And I had heard, and this was sort of over the Trump years a little bit, but some older women who I greatly hold in great esteem, kind of a little bit in a hyperbolic way saying, if I were terminally ill, I would consider doing a kind of a Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was this German theologian who tried to assassinate Hitler. So here is a Dietrich Bonhoeffer, pacifist, theologian, Christian pastor, who makes this decision that, the righteous thing to do is to kill the tyrant. So I heard enough of that chatter to want to explore it. And like you, I think... kind of nonviolent action is morally right and tactically and strategically in the United States, especially, probably, the only way to go. And yet, you could kind of understand, given the evidence, given the moment we're in, given the way the political system has been captured by the powerful fossil fuel industry, why people might think of desperate measures. And in Alter to an Erupting Sun, I kind of try to show a lot of different ways of people think about tactics. Here's Sam Lovejoy cutting down a tower. Well, that's property destruction. Here's Norman Morrison setting himself on fire outside the Pentagon. Well, that's a very self-harmful witness, but powerful. And then you have Ray's decision to engage in essentially political assassination. You have a whole range, including just war tax resistance, nonviolent protests. So part of the book is to sort of lift up and engage that tactical part of our brains as to how do we respond to the moment we're in. In addition to like, how do we prepare our communities? How do we kind of build place-based community resilience for the next 20 years of disruption that we're going to live through?
And I think that you, and thank you for that, because I think that's why it's so powerful to have, you know, the book start in 2023 and then jump to 2030, where people have been having to deal with, I mean, the woman I mentioned, Alex, who was the driver, ends up going to prison for 6 years. And, you know, what is it like for the people that Ray leaves behind? How did it affect them with, you know, the FBI and there, whatever? But like, just this idea, what does it say to what, you know, how can you, and I think that, you know, the question is, how could someone do that? And that's what you start to unravel. Like, okay, this, let's start with her childhood. Let's try to understand, which isn't to say you're justifying it at all. You're just saying, here's a thought experiment. Now, you're right. I think the fiction is the place for that, to ask these tough questions. And I admire that you're doing this, because I think, you know, again, we see violence everywhere in the world. And, you know, so, it helps to take a deep breath and I'm going to look at fiction now and see how this plays out instead of like on my TV screen, which is way too real. I just think congratulations on doing this. I want to ask, how was it to, you've done a lot of nonfiction writing. Have you been a fiction writer before? Or is this your first foray?
You know, I've written stories and I've tried to be a better storyteller in my nonfiction writing. But yeah, this is my first novel and maybe my last. It was the only one that sort of was knocking on my inner door and demanding to be written. And it was totally fun to work on, as you can appreciate, not a lot of footnotes. although I did do a lot of research on sort of the historical events that I was trying and tried to get them right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think, and I wanted to depict, I don't know, there's not a lot of fiction that I see that depicts activists, people who are what I would consider kind of lifelong committed to social change, particularly, you know, lifting up some of the women in this book who have, you know, been at it 50, 60 years. Mm-hmm. So that was very deliberate. The other thing I'll just say is I think it tries to depict the blowback of Ray's action, mm-hmm. And again, you know, yes. You talked about the impact of Ray's action on her family, but it was also, it led to the criminalization of protests. It led to repression. It led to the glorification of, it sort of set back the climate change movements.
Yep.
And it led to other witnesses. And there's a, it's sort of implied, but there's a moment where kind of moved by Ray's witness, six grandmothers self-immolate, set themselves on fire in the lobby of ExxonMobil. And that breaks through the sort of fog, if you will, in the society about why would these women do this? These are grandmothers. And they all had eloquent statements about why. So it was less Ray's action and more that kind of witness that actually started to change how society thought about the fossil fuel industry and really looked at the, you know, the carbon barons, the sort of war criminals of the climate movement, of the defending the fossil fuel industry, who kind of locked us on this course and ran out the clock. Mm. And so that was trying to imagine what would turn the corner in a dramatic way, because of course we kind of need to turn the corner in a dramatic way.
We do. And throwing paint on paintings doesn't seem like it's going to do much. Which is not to suggest that I'm endorsing. I just want to be clear. I'm not endorsing what Ray did, or I don't want anyone to set themselves on fire. This is a book. It's more about how do we shake people and awake them before it's too late. And it really feels like it is. So speaking of running the clock, you know, we are just getting started, and yet here we come to a close. It just means that people are going to have to go out and read The Wealth Hoarders. We're not going to tell you anything about it, but I think you can figure out by the title what it actually is about. And I learned so much from it. This is an area I'm greatly interested in, just as you are. But can I ask you, what did I not ask you? What did I forget to ask? And is there anything else you'd like to tell me?
Well, yeah, I would love to talk to you about the wealth hoarder someday, about how so much wealth is hidden to the shadows, and how do we find it and hold it accountable. But otherwise, I think that, I just came, I did an event at Middlebury College last week about Altar to an Erupting Sun, and it was called, okay. The frame was a sort of bold action on a warming planet. Mm-hmm. What does it look like? And I think that's sort of the invitation is, yes, we're, what Ray did was wrong, the fictional Ray Kelleher, but what are each of us called to do? What does bold action look like for each of us? And that's sort of the reflection that I hope the book inspires. And I did actually, this isn't just a promo. I mean, I put a website together around the book at chuckcollinswrites.com that has sort of links to all the historical references. So if somebody's like, oh, I want to know more about the School of Americas in Georgia and the movement to shut it down, or I want to see the video about Sam Lovejoy knocking the tower over in Montague, Massachusetts. A lot of those links are there, as well as Ray's reading list. And Ray, ooh, like you and I, are kind of like history nerds. She's a history nerd. And she loves books. She's actually bookish in a celebrated way. And so she, in fact, one of the reasons, they live in Boston, and they moved to Vermont in part because they've kind of been reading about the sort of climate future and reading fiction and nonfiction about where we're heading. And that what leads her to become, as she says, a late in life back to the lander. So
I love that. And so the name of the website, though, to get the so-called liner notes for the book is, you said Chuck Collins Writes, like R-I-G-H-T-S? So
Chuck Collins like writes with his pen.
Oh,
W-R-I-T-E-S. Chuck Collins
okay,
writes.
Okay, so Chuck Collins, spelled like you would think it would be spelled, writes.org?
.com.
God,
they both go there.
Either one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good. So we got it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been great catching up with you, even on a screen. And I hope that we can connect at one of these conferences where we can take a train and not a plane next time. I'm going down to DC on a train in a few weeks. I love doing that. So hopefully I will. Hopefully we'll connect somehow again in the future.
Look forward to it. And next time you come to Brattleboro, think of me. Give me a holler.
I will. I'll just go come picking berries and vegetables, although in the winter there aren't going to be many, but I will knock on your door, I promise.
We did just plant 5,200 garlic cloves, so come July, we got your garlic covered.
Okay. I will. I love that. You can't have too much garlic. If it calls for one clove, I'll put it all ahead of garlic. I don't care.
Good for you. But your kitchen smells good.
Absolutely. Thank you for spending this time with Chuck Collins and I. It was really nice to catch up with him after only seeing him in person once before and just knowing his words and his reputation on paper so well. He's a lovely person and is really, sounds like, carving out a wonderful life for himself and his family in Vermont right now. I do encourage you to take a look both at his novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun, and The Wealth Hoarders, or any of his many other books and papers that he's written on these very important topics of wealth inequality, racial injustice in America, and climate disruption. As he mentioned, you can find more about the details, the factual details backing up his novel Altar to an Erupting Sun by going to his website, which is chuckcollinswrites.org or chuckcollinswrites.com, and it's spelled chuckcollinswrites.org or .com. I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com. And you can always write to us on paper at Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast. Goodbye now and be well.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.